Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme...
If there's any amount of books written and teaching children to write and all the rest of it, that's fine. Every teacher has to find his or her way to do it. But if you don't have trust and openness and respect, you have nothing.
Retired teacher and practising poet Gabriel Fitzmaurice shares with me some of his views on teaching writing and teaching Irish. Sinead Burke has also been looking at the area of interactive whiteboards. But we begin with the second instalment in Barry Hennessy's series investigating the PISA test of reading, maths and science literacy, which has shaped policy interventions in Ireland over the last year.
The results of the 2009 PISA test in Irish schools led to unprecedented soul-searching over declining standards of literacy and numeracy among Irish teenagers. The newly elected coalition government lost no time in devising remedial strategies aimed at restoring Ireland to its former place among the leading OECD member states. So just what is different in countries that perform well in PISA? Canada consistently ranks among the top performers in the PISA tests. As in Ireland, the issue of educational outcomes garners much attention and has even been used for political gain in provincial elections. Hugo Rodriguez is a respected Canadian journalist who blogs about education matters on the website educationreporter.ca. I've been discussing the strengths of the Canadian education system with him, but we began by looking at variations in PISA scores across the country, where some of the larger and wealthier provinces significantly outperform their smaller, poorer relatives.
Some of the provinces score better than others. For example, Ontario, the province where I live, scores quite well, and certainly the government loved to remind us of that fact during a recent provincial election. Other provinces that have traditionally fared well are Alberta, British Columbia. Ones that have not fared as well include some of the smaller provinces, for example, Prince Edward Island. Smaller provinces who don't have the population base, while they may place a similar priority, their school systems are simply smaller, their provinces are smaller, they just don't have the same overall amount of money that they can throw around at a priority like education.
Okay, let's take a look at some of the factors that are seen as influencing the overall good scores in Canada. There is a strong culture, I understand, of standardized testing in schools in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And this, again, depends on which province you live in, but definitely Alberta and Ontario, British Columbia use provincially administered standardized testing in math and literacy skills that the students would take two or three times, again depending on the province, through their primary and secondary educational careers, and then the data from those tests is available to school districts and to schools, and the idea, though it's not always perceived this way in the media, the idea is that then those results should be guiding instruction so that teachers know where their students' strengths are, where they should be focusing on improving a particular skill set, be it comprehension or the ability to summarize or open response questions or a particular math skill. That's the strength of the data if it's used well. Of course, standardized testing can be quite political. Teachers' federations are often not in favor of it, so it also isn't always necessarily the good news story that it could be when it comes to improving those foundational skills, and also the corollary result the related result it has when we see those PISA results come up.
There is a standardized test that is done quite late in secondary education, I believe, and that students have to take that test as a prerequisite to going on to take their school leaving exams. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's correct. So high school or secondary school students in Ontario in their 10th year, which is a mere 2 years away from graduation, as only grade 12 is the highest year, have to do what's called the Ontario Secondary School Literacy Test. And it is a standardized test administered by the provincial testing agency, and they have to score a grade that would be equivalent to a letter grade of a B, which is mid-70 percentile, in order to be considered successful on that test. And successful completion of that test is a requirement for the secondary school diploma.
Is there a very significant emphasis placed on basic literacy and numeracy through primary education? Because the government here certainly has mandated an increase in the time spent on those particular aspects of the curriculum in primary from this autumn as a result of our decline in PISA 2009.
I would say that there has been, particularly in the last 7 to 8 years, certainly within, and again, the province I know the best, Ontario, there's actually a provincial secretariat whose sole focus is to work with school districts on teaching strategies and teacher professional development for teachers and for school administrators, all aimed at how we teach those foundational reading, writing, and mathematics skills. And certainly in the classroom visits that I've had the pleasure of doing in those early years, up to a third of the day, if not more, is spent on activities that reinforce these skills. It comes with its own criticism, of course. Those who feel that an overemphasis on reading, writing, and math comes at a detriment to arts education, to social science education, to physical education, feel that too heavy of a focus on these three skills means that students are suffering and are only learning these three skills, and they're doing so by sacrificing time that in earlier decades may have been spent on those other areas of what's considered a well-rounded education. The fascinating part about that is that the school districts and schools and teachers that understand how to integrate those topics can do it quite well. So they can be reinforcing a reading skill while they're doing a social science unit. And so as an outsider, when you look at that, is that time spent on a literacy skill, or is that time spent learning a social science unit?
And that was Hugo Rodriguez from educationreport.ca, closing Barry Hennessy's report on PISA. Barry will continue this series on next week's programme. I'm now joined by our reporter Sinead Burke, who's going to tell me all about interactive whiteboards. Sinead, when you buy an interactive whiteboard for your classroom, it's not enough just to buy the whiteboard, is that right?
It's not enough, no. When you buy an interactive whiteboard, usually there is a data projector which comes alongside the whiteboard, and also there is technology or software which comes along specific to that brand of whiteboard. But recently there have been new brands and new companies have brought out different types of interactivity, and this can be based on merely buying a data projector, which is Epson's latest piece of technology. It's called the Epson Brightlight. Priced at €1,600, it is an interactive data projector, and that projects on any flat surface, making it interactive.
Can you give me an example of any subject or any lesson you've taught where you felt the interactive whiteboard did something that could not have been done with chalk and the old-fashioned white blackboard?
I taught a lesson on New York a couple of weeks ago, and this is geography. And in the geography curriculum, the teachers are promoted to create a sense of place and a sense of space. But that's very difficult when you're talking about a place that isn't local to the children. And whilst they may have knowledge from television programmes or films or photographs, it's very difficult to exactly pinpoint where this location is or what people there might act like. I found a resource online called the Virtual Cam, and this hooks into CCTV cameras around the world, and this projects live images on the internet of every location around the world and shows children what is happening specifically in New York. And I chose cameras in Times Square, and children could see what was going on at Times Square at that very moment, see the people passing and assess maybe what those people are wearing, how is it different from Dublin or how is it different from Ireland, and with a chalkboard. And it just wouldn't, something like that would never have been possible, and the learning would not have been as positive.
So it's like as if there's a few different technologies coming together there. You have the internet, and then you have this way of projecting it onto the whiteboard so the class can see it.
Very much so. And then there's the video and the sound, and they could also, it could also have been linked to a music lesson in what sounds are in the environment in New York, and maybe record a feature in the sounds of the local environment to the school and compare and contrast. And the children were engrossed in the lesson, and I really do not think it would have been as positive if it was without this resource.
And for someone then who hasn't got an interactive whiteboard, what do they need to get started?
There are some new technologies coming on stream where an interactive whiteboard may not be the end all and be all, as they say. Hitachi have created a new form of technology called the Starboard Link Easy System, and that's based on e-beam. That sounds very complicated, but it is literally a widget that attaches to a whiteboard or to any surface, and instantly that surface becomes an interactive whiteboard. This piece of equipment costs €800, much less than a Promethean board, which may cost up to €3,000. Attached to a set of speakers, this can create multiple opportunities for learning in the classroom.
For people who have been using interactive whiteboards for a while, what is the state of the art with regard to whiteboards at the moment?
In most Irish classrooms, the competition is between Smartboards and Promethean. But there has been new developments recently in relation to not only being able to be interactive with the whiteboard by the pen supplied with the board, but in touching the board itself. And Promethean have released a new board which enables this new technology. With Promethean as well, there is software which comes with the board, and this has been great for lesson introductions or simple classroom management strategies.
And what kind of things can you do with that inbuilt software in the Promethean?
You can install backgrounds into your portfolios and into your flip charts, but you can also include things like clocks if you are teaching time, which work. You can include lesson beginners such as simple maths activities and games. I'm in no way attached to Promethean, so I'm not sponsoring their software, but it is of the best kind, and that is what keeps Promethean at the top of the charts in interactive whiteboards. But there's many different companies, and Epson have brought out a new projector which gives great interactivity, and it's the first of its kind available in Ireland. But this software also allows multiple people to use the interactive whiteboard at once. This was a difficulty previous to other interactive whiteboards where only the teacher or one student at a time could be interactive on the board, but this new one allows multiple people to use the board.
One of the problems that can happen, Sinead, is people can use an old-fashioned marker on a whiteboard. Does that damage the whiteboard?
Smartboard have released research recently to state that you can use dry white markers on their smartboard and it won't affect. And this is the latest thing to come out in terms of interactive whiteboards, that you can use this. It has a dual purpose. Promethean have announced that although they wouldn't recommend using dry white markers on their whiteboard, the dry white markers should come off, so it should relieve some stress amongst the teaching community.
You mentioned the price of the Hitachi model. What is the price of a standard Promethean or a smartboard package?
A standard smartboard package costs €3,000, and the new Promethean board, that costs €3,249. And that's for the latest with the touchscreen technology and also with the pen.
And for people who want to find out more, are there websites that they can go to or any that you would recommend in particular?
In relation to interactive whiteboards, the new thing which will come on board is online communities. And the one interactive whiteboard company which excels at this is Promethean. And they have an online site called Promethean Planet. And there you can upload your own flip charts and converse with others amongst the interactive whiteboard community. And that would be the one I would most recommend for those who are looking to see how flip charts work. But that software will work with Promethean software mainly.
And what about websites then that review interactive whiteboards?
Whilst doing some research, the most productive website which I found was www.onshaw.net, and they do extensive reviews on all different types of software, particularly interactive whiteboards and projectors, and you will get the latest news and features about software and technology coming up there. It's fantastic.
And where do you see interactive whiteboards going from here, Sinead?
The talk at the moment is that in the future there will be less emphasis placed on the hardware and the software of the interactive whiteboards. But with Promethean, they have such a hold on the online community market that companies such as Smartboard and Hitachi will look to develop their online communities. And this is where they think the future of interactive whiteboards will be, and progressing that software and progressing their flip chart basis, their flip charts online, and developing their community greater online.
And Sinead will be back with another report on next week's programme. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, which is insideed.com. Gabriel Fitzmaurice is a retired primary school teacher and principal from Myvan in County Kerry. He is the author of more than 30 books, including collections of poetry in English and Irish. He was a friend of both Brian McMahon and John B. Keane. During the summer, I met up with Gabriel, and in future programmes I'll bring you some of his story. But this week I'm bringing you some of his thoughts on teaching children Irish and teaching them to write. I began by asking Gabriel how he taught the children in his class to write.
First of all, I wonder if you can teach anybody to write. For instance, just to go back to my own time in school, you were... You weren't asked to write poetry or anything like that, or stories even. You were given compositions, essays to write. Nothing wrong with writing essays. It's a fine form of literature. But my mother never let me write an essay. She always wrote it for me. And it wasn't because she was making me lazy. She wanted me to see good English. My mother had, as I said, she had a good education. She had a leaving cert at a time when nobody had. She had English, Irish and French. And she was passionately interested in literature. So that would be not the way to teach English nowadays or writing nowadays, but that worked for me. Now, how did I go about it? First of all, when you've got a range of first to sixth class, that different techniques are going to apply, isn't there? But first of all, is I never stopped anybody saying anything they wanted to say, as long as it was true. That's the first rule we had. You can say anything you like here. There's no sanctions being imposed on the truth. And things did come out at times that, you know, difficult things in that. There was one particular essay I gave. It was just I asked the children to write about themselves, and one girl finished up. She came from a poorer part of the parish, and you know, the family wouldn't have had the most money, and they wouldn't have had the fanciest of clothes, and maybe clothes would have been handed down from sister to sister or brother to brother. But she finished that anyway, and she said the whole thing, the whole truth, known to be respected. But the last line she said was, "I'm proud to be me." And I wrote a poem about it, and I actually called the book that the poem is in for children, "I'm Proud to Be Me." Like, that's the first thing. Children, they must be allowed to express themselves. After that, you're teaching techniques, and you're teaching, this will work in poetry, and you start them off with acrostics, and then you go to haikus and all this kind of stuff. But the real I was going to say trick, except it's not a trick. The real technique is if there's trust in a class, you'd be amazed what happens, and if children are allowed to flourish. And that's really what I would say. Even when I go and give workshops, you know, even to adults, you'll find, first of all, if it's a 3-day workshop, the first day you go into the first 2 hours, and they're usually two-hour sessions every day, everybody's kind of nervous and looking at each other and not wanting to share and not wanting to open up. But the trick is, like, and again, the technique, I use the word trick, it's not a good word, is to get them to open up. And if children can open up in trust and respect, they're right. The rest is homekeeping, housekeeping stuff, you know. I mean, there's any amount of books written by people like Michael Rosen and various, Pat Borden in Ireland, on the poetry work, the portable poetry workshop, and teaching children to write and all the rest of it. That's fine. Every teacher has to find his or her way to do it. But if you don't have trust and openness and respect, you have nothing.
I suppose one thing that surprises me there, Gabriel, is that when you talk about the truth and the importance of the truth, is it's like as if you don't get the children to write any fantasy work or any fiction.
Oh, you do. Yeah. That's later. Stories. Fiction, of course, yeah. Fiction is, in an era now of computers and all the rest of it, I've heard Eddie Lenihan, the great story writer, recently say that the era of stories is over. I don't think he's right. And to give you an instance of it, when Brian McMahon died, it's 13 years ago now, I think, my son John would have been in fourth class at the time, I think, and I would have had maybe a second class teaching them. And I said to John, Brian, I got a phone call from the McMahons that morning that Brian was dying. He wouldn't last the day. He was in Dublin in hospital. So I said, I'm going to read a Brian McMahon story to the kids today. And I said to John, what will I read? Will I read The Windows of Wonder? He said, no, that's too hard for him. Read them Jack and Moira and the King of Ireland's Son. It's an old folk tale that Brian translated from Irish to English. And I did. And it took about 50 minutes to read it, from beginning to end. And at the end of the story, there was a, like that from the kids, a sigh of wonder and relief and pleasure. And I said, "Did you enjoy that?" "Yeah." And then I asked them about the television programmes they were watching at the time. I said, "Was that as good as Gigantor?" "Yeah, better." "Was that as good as Pokemon?" "Yeah, better. Way, way better." So children love stories. And again, like, if you can just find that imagination. Brian McMahon used to talk about the windows of wonder. That's why he was talking about reading the windows of wonder. Like, if you can open up their eyes to the wonder of the universe and the wonder of their own beings, and the wonder of story and fiction and imagination, if you can get them into that area, that's just as good as the other area I was talking about, which is telling the truth and respecting each other and that. And, yeah, I mean, again, it's a question. I'm not big into techniques, I'll be honest with you. I'm far more interested in opening up in honesty and truth and respect and respecting what people do. And one of the great things that we had in the 71 curriculum was don't destroy the story with red marks. You know, correct the most common misspelling and leave it at that, or the most common grammatical thing. There's another space for a grammar lesson. There's another space for a spelling lesson. But in the writing lesson, don't kill it with grammar and spelling. That was what I thought anyway.
And if you don't want to get hung up then on strategy or technique, how do you stimulate the child who is sitting with a blank page in front of them to get started with writing?
I'll be honest with you, I never had that difficulty. It's far more in art. I found it in art was far more difficult to get the child who wasn't interested in painting or drawing or modelling or sculpting or whatever. Particularly the white page, like, they would get stuck in with the old models and stuff like that, but the white page in front of them with the brush in their hand, I don't know what to do, sir. Or they never call me sir, it's Gabriel. I found it in writing. If you sat down beside somebody and had a chat with him, you know, if you could see somebody obviously pushing the pen around idly, you know, in his hand and fiddling with it, that he or she was in trouble, and you'd sit down and have a chat with him, well, you know, supposing it was a story that you were writing them, well, did you hear any stories lately? Did anybody tell you a story? Do you like stories? What do you like about stories? What people interest you? Are you frightened of anything? Do you love anything? And that kind of way you could sort of psych them into it. The other sort of stuff of writing about themselves and writing about their teaching and writing the truth and respect, I never had any difficulty there. Never. Nobody ever bogged down.
You have a love of the Irish language as well, Gabriel. How did you go about passing on that love to the children in your classes over the years?
A lot of the time I did it by poetry. I remember growing up in the school and that, and learning fine poems in Irish, but they would have been difficult, like, even for us at the time that had good Irish, like the Spalpeen Fánach and stuff like that, you know. Sometime about 1973 or 4, I'm not sure of the exact date now, Gabriel Rosenstock published a book of poems called An Octopus, like Dante Ella for children, The Octopus and other children's poems. Marvellous stuff. Simple vocabulary. Real poetry. A lot of the poetry you got when I came out in 71 was rhyming rubbish. You know, it was there for the sake of the rhyme. And not, there was nothing sexy in it for children, and nothing sensational in it for children, or whatever, you know, or romantic for children, or whatever you want to say. Sad for children. Children can quite cope with sad poems as well. But Rosenstock was there. He was zany. He was philosophical. He was funny. His Irish was good. His Irish was simple. And that's one of the ways in which I wanted to engage them in Irish. Because poetry is a great old way. I never made a difference between poetry in Irish and poetry in English. It was the poetry class. And I eventually wound up translating Rosenstock for publication years later from Mercier Press. But again, poetry is a language of the spirit. And like art and drama and stuff like that. And drama is another way of doing it. I mean, I don't know if you remember the old Kémena in the Buntus. Kéma Cúig was drama. And you dramatise situations, with obviously with the help of the teacher and vocabulary and stuff like that. And, you know, letting children say as much as they could in Irish. And if they had to break down into English, well, so be it. We can get over that another day. But I suppose the whole thing, like, is if you love a thing. I was handy at Irish going to school. I didn't particularly like it, but I was handy at it. And I didn't actually begin to like Irish until I went back to the Gaeltacht. Where, for obvious reasons, you know, at 11 years of age, when you'll be just on the the edge of puberty and all the rest, you'd be going to Kayleigh's and meeting girls and talking to an Irish, you know, Jesus. I didn't do that in school, you know. And for that reason, I've always loved the Irish language. Ever since I began to go back there and meet the girls in the Kayleigh's, I associate Irish as a kind of a marvellous summer. The summers I spent back there in fine weather, talking to girls and not even kissing them, like, but just talking to them, you know. And I think if you have an infectious enthusiasm for something, that will transfer to your pupils. If you don't like something, like, children are very fast to cop on to what's going on in the class. And if you're reluctant about what you're teaching, the children will be reluctant to learn it. And if you're violent about what you want, I mean, the teachers we had now, the taught us Irish, were very, very good. I don't know that there was an enthusiasm for it. They just sort of demanded that you learn it. And you learn the grammar and all the rest of it. And that was one way of teaching it, but that wouldn't work nowadays. You have to be enthusiastic, though. You're going to girls' school, and you're going to ordinary schools as well. And you see the enthusiasm, particularly of younger teachers. And, I mean, that's how I tried.
And you even found in your own class, say, that working with poems and doing a lot of poems, Trí Gaeilge, that was enough to get the children talking, even themselves, in Irish.
I know. The poems Trí Gaeilge would have given them an interest in poetry, an interest in the Irish language, and a certain vocabulary. Then you had to use that formally in you know, I mean, there's Cora, Fhiramúr, and Cora, and Na Fhiramúr as we had in our time. And I was never too interested in the Na Fhiramúr and Fhiramúr. The whole thing was Cora as far as I was concerned. And if you just got them talking, and you know, different kids according to their abilities would do more. And also writing Irish was important. You know, filling in the blanks, that's what you did for a finish, like, say, in the junior and middle classes. They couldn't write whole sentences. So the workbooks had it, but you could also put it on the blackboard, or have it on a chart, or give them out photocopy sheets with so much there in the picture, and, you know, they put in the missing word, and as they progressed, more and more blank space and stuff like that. Still, though, I mean, I can say that they were fluent Irish speakers when they left my Van National School, and it's no more than any other school, you know.
And, of course, I couldn't speak to Gabriel without asking him to read one of his poems for us. He'll introduce it himself.
This is the one I was telling you about earlier on, about the little girl who said, "I'm proud to be me." She would have been about 9, I'd say, when she wrote it. Maybe 10. I'd say 9-ish, 10-ish. And I'm very friendly with her father. He used to play the banjo with me when we used to play in pubs when we were younger. And I wrote this for her because the last line is her line. "I'm proud to be me. Though you live in a house with a proper address and wear proper clothes, not my hand-me-down dress, though you think that you're better than I'll ever be, and look down on our equals, I'm proud to be me."
And that poem comes from Gabriel's collection, Proud to Be Me, published by Mercier Press. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest, Gabriel Fitzmaurice, and to my colleagues, Barry Hennessy and Sinead Burke. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.